you can transform a city based on the time of day. A city does not have to be static. And I think we need to be more flexible in terms of our urban planning to see how we can utilize the public space, the public room, the public living room, as it could be for some people, for when people are out and about. And of course, there are some streets that will always have to be accessible with cars. But there are some streets that doesn't have to be accessible with your own car all the time.
Willkommen bei Freifahrt, dem Interview-Podcast zum Thema Mikromobilität rund um Fahrräder, E-Scooter, Lastenfahrräder und neuen Fahrzeugkonzepten. Hier spreche ich mit Expertinnen, Unternehmerinnen, Herstellern, Entscheidern, Enthusiasten und auch Kritikern über die Zukunft der Mobilität. Mich interessiert, warum das Fahrrad seit 200 Jahren existiert und E-Scooter innerhalb von weniger als 2 Jahren in aller Munde sind. Ich möchte herausfinden, was wir tun müssen, damit Mikromobilität mehr Beachtung bei der Verkehrsplanung bekommt und wir so in Zukunft in gesünderen und lebenswerteren Städten leben können. Mich fasziniert, warum es in Holland und Dänemark selbstverständlich ist, mit einem Lastenfahrrad unterwegs zu sein und wir hierzulande kostenlosen Parkraum wiederum als selbstverständlich erachten. Ich möchte von meinen Gesprächspartnern und Gesprächspartnerinnen lernen und so für euch einen 360-Grad-Blick auf Fahrzeuge, Anbieter, Strategien, Politik bedenken und Potenziale werfen. Mein Name ist Sebastian Hofer und heute spreche ich mit Sigrid Dahlbeck-Krajewski. Sie ist Head of Marketing and Communications beim litauischen Maas-Softwareanbieter Trafi. Und auch wenn Sigrid hervorragend Deutsch versteht, wie ich gelernt habe, ist die Folge diesmal auf Englisch. Für alle, die Trafi noch nicht kennen, Trafi ermöglicht Städten und Unternehmen die Einführung und den Betrieb eigener Mobility-as-a-Service-Lösungen, damit diese ihre Mobilitätsökosysteme konzipieren, analysieren und verstehen können. Das bisher bekannteste Produkt ist die Berliner App Yelby, welche eine Vielzahl an Mobilitätsangeboten tiefenintegriert vereint. Ich hätte gedacht, dass wir über Maas-Software, Aggregation und Tiefenintegration sprechen würden. Stattdessen aber haben wir über Konzepte für Lebenswerte und sogenannte flexible Städte gesprochen. Sigrid hatte vor Trafi beruflich nichts mit Mobilität zu tun, was ich verpirrend fand, denn sie spricht leidenschaftlich, idealistisch und philosophisch visionär darüber, wie Echtzeitdaten, Vorhersagen oder Gamification mittels Software die Prise Nutzerzentrierung in die noch sehr starre Welt der Mobilität und Städteplanung bringen kann. Damit das passieren kann, ist sie überzeugt, brauchen Städte als Hauptakteure die richtigen digitalen Werkzeuge an die Hand. Am besten hat mir der Gedanke hier gefallen, Infrastruktur und Mobilitätsangebote flexibler zu denken und die Nutzung und Relevanz in kürzeren Schleifen zu überprüfen, so wie es eben die Tech-Welt vormacht. Denn dann könnten wir über tagesabhängige Sperrungen von Straßen, AB-Testing von Ideen und Inzentivierung je nach Witterung oder Verkehrssituation nachdenken, was den Kopf nochmal richtig neu öffnen würde. Ich fand das Gespräch derbe inspirierend, da Sigrid nicht dogmatisch auf der einen Ideallösung rumreitet und dennoch Klarstellung bezieht. Nun aber hört selbst, was sie Spannendes zu sagen hat und viel Spaß mit der bisher längsten Freifahrtfolge.
That was a very, very passionate talk and monologue. Not really a monologue, that was really a passionate statement.
I hope it was a dialogue.
It was a dialogue, but in the end you had a very passionate statement on the panel on the Wunder Mobility Summit right now, and I appreciate that. And I also appreciate having you on my podcast. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's so nice to be in this room, and it feels like we have our own satellite event.
It does, yeah. It feels like a little studio up here. So thanks also to Wunder Mobility for having or letting us sit in this little office. And it's quite exciting having you on the podcast because I don't know if you remember the last time we met at Micromobility, I already said that you're probably the most charming podcast voices out there, especially mobility. So this is a thing, especially because I wanted to be more German on the podcast, but I thought this is something I can't miss. So yeah. Let's start.
Thank you. What an introduction.
All right. Micromobility and Trafi, maybe to start having a little background of what you do, who you are. And we already talked about this in the conversation before this recording. You have hardly any background in mobility if you look at your CV, but now you have this passionate idea of livable cities. Who are you? What is Trafi? And
what do I do here?
Exactly.
I do not have a traditional mobility background. That is absolutely true. But I've been in quite a lot of different industries and governmental institutions that are digitalizing some sector of a part of your life that you need, whether we're talking about traveling, where I worked for Trivago, whether we're talking about the fact that you actually have to cover your body with something. I used to work for Zalando, e-commerce company. I've been part of the Swedish Foreign Ministry for quite a few years, working for different embassies.
I saw that Pakistan as well, right?
Pakistan, that was not the Swedish embassy. So Pakistan has an embassy in Stockholm.
Yeah.
And I was working for them there. And that was very interesting.
Okay.
Different from working for one of my national embassies.
I bet. Did you ever get to go to Pakistan for a while?
Yeah, I had the option to go, but in the end I decided not to because the situation was not so stable at the time. But I would love to visit someday because I obviously have a close connection to the country since I worked with the countryman for about a year. But now I find myself in mobility, which is also an industry that is under a huge digitalization wave and that needs to digitalize. And where we see so many gaps of where cities and providers are still working together on a very analog way. And I hope that technology and the developments that we're experiencing now can fill that gap.
And that gap would be getting towards a more smart city, or is that... you don't like the term,
hey? Such a leading question.
Yeah.
You know that I don't like that epithet because... what is a smart city? And if we want to move towards smart cities, does it mean that we currently live in dumb cities?
I guess.
Is a dumb city?
Yeah.
I would rather say that we should specify what we mean. What is a smart city? Is smart something which is self-optimizing? Is smart something which is completely digital? Is smart something that is flexible? What does smart mean?
I think usually smart is meant if you have data that you can monitor, that you make something out of, that you optimize, that you create like business models on top of it. I think this is the usually what you if you talk about smart in any other industries, isn't it?
But that's something that's data-driven, and that data is not necessarily smart. What is smart is to analyze data and draw conclusions of what you can change for the better. That's something which is smart. And for me, that's a city which is more optimizing its status quo into something which is an elevated state or an elevated stage. So rather looking into what different holes could a city fill with the utilization of data or technology or any other type of innovation, which makes it better. But just having data is not smart per se. And we discussed a little bit earlier that maybe we should talk about having more livable cities instead. What does that mean?
Yeah, what does it mean for you? What would be a livable city if you live in Berlin, as far as I understand, and then before you lived in Düsseldorf, and then you are from Stockholm?
Yes.
So you have quite, and then all the other cities that you just mentioned.
Yeah,
what was it?
Also
Hong Kong?
Budapest, Bangkok, and Gothenburg. So I've been in a few different cities. And I think a livable city for me is a place where you can move freely, and that does not only mean move freely in terms of transportation, but move freely because the air is clean, because there are roads to walk on. You don't have to access any type of transportation to get around the city. You can actually do it with your own 2 feet. A livable city is a place where you have space to live, as in you can afford to rent an apartment. Maybe you can even afford to build a house outside the city borders. You have access to nice restaurants and cafes, but at the same time, there's also public space where you can sit for free. A city is a place where people live, love, eat, work, breathe, but not only a place where you sleep, go to work, and work. For me, that's not a livable city. That's just a place where you happen to be.
I'm just thinking, or the thought comes up, that if you think about Hong Kong, or maybe I have never been to Bangkok, but...
it's crazy.
It is great?
Yeah. It's crazy.
It's what?
Crazy.
Crazy. Oh, yeah. I would say I would say it's crazy. But I'm thinking, what you just said, lots of it is also based on the monetization and maybe creating business models with urban space. And sometimes this is something that makes sense from all kinds of different standpoints, but doesn't make a lot of sense from just creating maybe the or increasing quality of life, where you just mentioned that having public space, which is not necessarily allocated to any business, but just for sitting around maybe or reading newspapers. It is something where do you think we need a new discussion in cities to allocate space differently based on different motives?
We need those spaces, and it's not up to the city to only provide spaces where there's a commercial business involved. Mm-hmm. The city has an obligation to provide a space where you can roam around freely as a citizen with your own 2 feet, to read a book, to enjoy the sunlight, to have a look at the trees without having to pay to be there. That's the right of a citizen. That's why you want to live in cities. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we could just build complexes in the countryside and shuttle people to that space. The city has an allure in itself, and cities have to take care so it's not lost.
But on the other side, if you think there's one example in Hamburg where they shut down a couple of streets where you can't use your private car anymore, or hardly any car, like some commercial cars for delivering goods in the morning, for example. But apart from that, you can only access it by feet and bicycles. Shop owners, for example, they protested and they keep protesting against it because they see a loss in revenue, which is funny because studies, as far as I know, always say that if you have accessibility of your shop not only by car but something else, and you have more occasional users. So I'm wondering if your argument is different if you ask representatives of cities, who then again need to talk to shop owners, who say, fine what you say, but we need people to get into our stores, and therefore we need accessibility for all means of transport.
You can't have this status everywhere. It needs to be adaptable. But say, for example, the street that you're mentioning, it's not black and white per se. So a compromise, and I'm coming from the country of compromises, being Sweden, is that you can turn specific streets into walking streets at a certain point of the day.
Mm-hmm, okay.
When, for example, the shops are closed, or when people, sometime after they have left their workspace, you can transform a city based on the time of day. A city does not have to be static. And I think we need to be more flexible in terms of our urban planning to see how we can utilize the public space, the public room, the public living room, as it could be for some people, for when people are out and about. And of course, there are some streets that will always have to be accessible with cars. But there are some streets that doesn't have to be accessible with your own car all the time.
Is that a smart city then? Because we have intelligent algorithms.
That's a flexible city.
That's a flexible city.
That's a flexible city.
Okay.
And a livable city. I'm not sure if this is smart per se, but it's a city that meets the demands of its citizens. And that's not only about creating accessibility, but it's also about creating a space where you want to be, where you want to enjoy yourself. And I think that's sometimes a little bit missed in mobility. Yes, we talk about how to get from A to B, but what makes you want to go from A to B? This is also a question that cities have to deal with.
I also like the idea of Horace, that he always points out that I think he says you don't measure miles, you measure smiles.
Yeah.
And he also says that if you think about what you can do with micromobility, again, getting back to the topic of the podcast, then having a bicycle, for example, or a scooter or anything which is in that scope of under 500 kilos and so on, gives you maybe access to places where you wouldn't go with your car, for example. So my question would be, how do you see micromobility as something that can enhance or maybe also reduce quality of life in a city? Or the idea of livable cities?
This is highly connected to policy and infrastructure, in my opinion. Micromobility is a form of transportation that can make life a lot more enjoyable and easy for people, especially when we talk about first and last mile. However, it also has the possibility to make people really annoyed, especially when we look at parking places, when we look at specific parks that are scattered with unusable vehicles, lakes, rivers, etc. Who's going to pick it up? It poses both opportunities and obstacles. And one of the main levers that we can use to actually sort it out and make it into an innovation which is mainly adding to a positive effect is by utilizing regulation that is based on real-time data, so data-driven decision-making again, and also make room in our current infrastructure for new mobility.
Right.
At the moment, infrastructure is not flexible, per se.
Not really, no.
And it has not been adapted to new forms of micromobility. And here I'm not only talking about e-kick scooters or scooters, also about increased usage of bikes, for example. Where should they park? Mm-hmm. There's not specific parking spaces in most European cities for this now. I know that they're piling it out, for example, in Paris, and that's great.
Mm-hmm. But in Stockholm as well,
in Stockholm
I think,
too.
Yeah.
But they need to, the city needs to have data about the usage of new types of mobility in order to know where, how, and when to change infrastructure and policy. And if they don't have this information, how can they make sure that infrastructure is mirroring new demands and new needs if they don't know about it?
How do they get the data, which I think you have an answer to, given the company that you work for?
The cities all across the world have to really be vocal about their right to access data. Mm-hmm. Because the city is not only responsible for the infrastructure, they're also responsible for policy making and taxation. And ultimately, the roads that you put your vehicles on are maintained by the city.
Right.
So there is a fundamental gap in terms of information where new types of mobility is entering those roads, but the information is locked with private providers.
Right.
And in a smart city or in a flexible city or in a more livable city, self-optimizing city, future city, the city has access to that information, can analyze it in real time and create both on-demand policy, policy that is flexible, and adapt infrastructure to whatever situation or context one finds oneself in.
That would eventually mean that cities and officials of cities are more or think in a more agile, maybe, and user-centric way, isn't it? Because as far as I experience this, nowadays, especially infrastructure, something that you build for 20 years, and I'm pretty sure that people are very happy, like once they decided about a concept and started to building roads or whatever it is, then they're happy with the result for a while, need to keep it like that. So what you say sounds as if there's not only the need for data, but also the need for the right mindset and also the ability to question things in a more repetitive, iterative way.
Definitely. I think cities can learn a lot from the technology industry. What you mentioned sounds a lot like A-B testing.
Yeah, it does. And which is funny if you think about building parking lots or streets. And it didn't work, let's do something else.
That's of course something that you can use on some things, but perhaps not on high scale projects. But the same mindset of testing things out, being a little bit more flexible, being in tune with the current environment, that's highly important. And you talk about building infrastructure for the next 20, 30, 40 years. And previously this has been done based on assumptions of what one think that society will look like.
True.
But the technology we have in place today can actually allow us to make predictions about how society will look, how roads will change, how demographics will change. And being able to simulate certain changes in society is also something that can make future infrastructure based on very, very close predictions, sometimes even on real-time data, which makes it way more accurate. So what we need to do and where we need to move towards is to take everything physical and make a digital twin.
Okay, so that that sounds interesting.
You mentioned A-B testing. Mm-hmm. Imagine that instead of doing that in real life, like on your street, you would do it on your laptop and you could see basically how things would look like with simulation.
All right.
And then assess if it's a good idea or not. Many cities, when e-kick scooters came into the picture, had no idea what was going to happen because they had no experience with it before. And imagine then that you would have had a tool where you could have simulated how it's going to affect the city by putting in 125,000 scooters in the city center, voila, perhaps not something you would want to do without regulation.
But isn't that something the traffic planners are doing, or companies like PTV with all kinds of simulation software, forecasting software? Isn't that out there already? I would assume
sometimes
that as a stupid citizen, I would say there got to be some planning and some brains behind what they do out there.
Sometimes, but it's not always that sophisticated. And you still have a lot of public transit agencies that have very limited ideas of how people are actually utilizing their transportation network, other than seeing what type of tickets they buy.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more because, yeah.
So you, just to give you a practical example, there's plenty of transit agencies all over Europe who get their main information about their citizens by going out on the street with a pen and pencil and asking them, how are you traveling today?
Yes.
Then it's put in an Excel sheet, and then it's analyzed, and 2 years later you have some insights which are then completely old.
That's true.
It's not enough anymore. We need to have something which is accurate, which we can get in a fast manner so that we can react. But not only react, being able to be proactive. Mm-hmm. Mobility cannot only be about reactiveness and trying to figure out, assume what people want. It has to be in some form based on data. If we would utilize the same type of methodology to any other type of industry, say the medical industry, we think this will happen if we put this pill in your body, but we don't know, so I'm going to ask you in a day how you feel.
Mm. That would be,
it wouldn't cut it. So why are we doing this to mobility?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think working for public transport, I think the idea of user-centric development and the reason, the history where public transport came from didn't really take into account the necessity to think, why are people actually using this now that we don't have factories and like central workplaces anymore? Mm-hmm. So the idea, the purpose of travel changes, and also the vehicle types change, and therefore the opportunity what you can do with it, and then the range where you can want to do, and then the flexibility, and then you have all kinds of apps like what you provide, for example. And then all of a sudden, there's huge potential of what you can actually do. And then I bet cities, and therefore I support your thought, maybe are also overwhelmed by the complexity, what to do for the citizens.
And I would say not only the complexity, but also the sheer volumes, because mm-hmm. they're also increasing in a speed that we have rarely seen before. And a buzzword that is going around mobility at the moment are the numbers from the UN, where by 2050, 65% of the entire urban population will live in cities. And this is a huge number. It's almost incomprehensible.
Yeah.
Therefore, we cannot only talk about micromobility. We need to talk about mass transit. How can we move an insane amount of people in a convenient way, which is friction-free, which is affordable, which is equitable, and which is accessible for the largest possible amount of people in any given city and the regions.
And which takes into account data privacy, because if you think about real-time information about where people move, then it's not far away to think about the monitoring system that's being implemented in China, for example, mm-hmm. where you know what people do on a real-time basis based on lots of cameras and technology. So
absolutely,
that is also not really a vision or an idea where you want to go to. So where do you get the real-time information to understand what you people do? I mean, obviously it starts if you have an application that covers most of modes in a city, then you know, okay, these kinds of person, this kind of target group uses mobility in this way, uses maybe a connection of public transport with bikes or with cars or with anything that you can imagine in the future. And this then, of course, helps to understand a little bit more what people actually do, why they are out there, and
absolutely.
Where they want to go.
And I think there it's really important to point out that it's not about individual people, it's about patterns. And what one tries to look at is, how can we meet the demands of certain user groups? What are changes? What are early adapters doing? Etc. It's not about pinpointing what Thomas Schmidt, 35 years old, from Friedrichshain, is doing, because that's not interesting.
Yeah.
But we want to know, what people like Thomas is doing so that we can meet him mm-hmm. and make the service more adapted towards his personal needs. This is a huge challenge, combining the ability to do mass transit, mass transportation, with the need for personalizing your offer, because people have such different preferences.
They do, yeah. Essentially, mobility is also a commodity these days, or should become one maybe eventually. And then also the question, of course, is of the cities or then PTAs or public transport operators to organize mobility and also to eventually suggest what makes sense from a daily standpoint, especially if I think at Yelby, the app that you built for BVG, the public transport operator in Berlin. Nowadays gives you a whole range of options, like a one-stop shop for mobility solutions. And then if I'm there, it helps me a lot to understand or to access mobility. For me, for example, was the first time I used Bergkönig because I didn't want to download the app again. It's like,
of
all right,
course, and that's
fair.
The point.
But the next point is, if you want to change mobility in a certain way, and that should be the goals of a city, for example, how do you prioritize offers, and whose obligation, whose responsibility is it to prioritize, and based on which? Did you ever discuss these things internally for Berlin or other cities that you operate in?
So this is really a question for the governmental bodies within any type of city. Mm-hmm. It's not something that we as a technology provider feel that we have the mandate to do, and we shouldn't do that either.
But you could consult and suggest
at
least.
We could consult and we could suggest, but that should be on the basis of, for example, environmental targets that the city has proposed.
Yes.
And if they have a plan for what they want to change, then what we can facilitate is the technological solution to do so. Mm-hmm. And what you could, for example, do in a mobility service solution that we're building for several different cities across Europe is to incentivize certain type of travels during certain types of hours of the day.
Yeah.
So say, for example, during rush hour, where it makes less sense to take your own personal car and increase congestion, then it would make sense to lower the prices for public transportation or for any type of environmental friendly transport like a bike sharing service.
Yes.
Meanwhile, in the middle of the night, where the S-Bahn or U-Bahn or the buses are running quite scarcely, perhaps then it makes sense to take your own car.
Yes.
So we can't really say that there's one incentive or one model that fits all, but rather look at the contextuality with which in the entire mobility network operates at and within, to see where we can have the biggest impact and to what extent people are fine with it.
Which again brings us to the point to understand people's behavior in, or like not behavior, but travel patterns to be able to cater to these, to the things that you just said, right?
And it's, I think sometimes what is a little bit forgotten is we talk about incentives, so pushing people to do something. We talk about punishment, pushing people to not do something. Mm-hmm. But in between, we have a little friend called convenience. Mm-hmm. And one of the easiest ways to get people to change their behavior is to show that an alternative is much more convenient, nice to use, smooth, better experience than what they're currently doing. Mm-hmm. You would not have changed from buying your own CDs into Spotify if buying CDs was still more convenient.
That is, yeah, absolutely. I agree. It's like talking sense into people and telling them this or that.
Yeah,
like
but it's
running.
Also, it takes a long time. You can't change people's behavior within a day.
Of course you can't.
So we need to combine incentives. We need to combine decentralizing methods and convenience to push a behavioral change.
Right.
And it can come bottom up, it could also come top down, it could also come from companies and corporations. Imagine that instead of getting a company car, you would get a mobility budget.
Right, good
this
point.
This is also a way that businesses have to take a responsibility to actually shift people's mindset in terms of providing benefits.
And they have huge responsibility given that...
And a huge reach.
Huge reach, responsibility. And I think their numbers, like SUVs in Germany, like more than 80% of the streets out there are company cars. So yeah. I agree, there's also a huge... but if you convince of all this so intensely... Why aren't you in politics? Why do you try to
maybe
change?
I should go into politics.
Yeah, maybe. Well, you, as far as I understand, you were. At least you have the background. You could.
Yeah. Let's see. Let's see what if I could even get accepted by a German party.
Why don't you go back to Sweden and do it there?
Oh, because...
I mean, you're welcome in Germany.
Well, thank you so much.
I
like it so much. I want to stay for a little bit longer.
Go ahead.
And
your name, I think, would make for a great chancellor's surname.
Oh, you think so?
Well, yeah. Better than the potential AKK, which is...
So I would be SDK?
You would
be... It has a nice rhyme to it.
Exactly. Yeah? Especially coming from a tech company.
I know.
You ever thought about this?
It has crossed my mind. Thank you very much.
I don't know.
No, I think politics is an amazing area. And at some point, I could definitely see myself going back. Mm-hmm. What is something that I do not like about politics is that it's slow, and currently everything is moving at quite a high pace. And I think politicians need to become better at educating themselves of what is going around them, not only, as I said earlier today, not only posing with the latest new trendy e-kick scooter.
Oh, yeah.
Pushing it on their Instagram channel and like feeling like they're part of the groove, that's okay, and that's part of the educational process. But as a politician, you have the responsibility to understand what is going on around you. Mm-hmm. And one of the industries that are changing in the most fundamental way at the moment is mobility.
It's mobility, yeah, absolutely.
If you think that just getting on a scooter is enough, you're wrong. Mm. You need to talk to the SaaS providers, you need to talk to the MaaS providers, you need to talk to the OEMs, you need to talk to the operators, you need to talk to the vulnerabilities of the world. At the same time, you need to talk to the Emmys, the Coupes, the Tiers, whatnot. You have to understand the ecosystem and try to figure out where the state or the public transit authorities, where their role is. Is the state an entrepreneur? Probably not. But should the state or the government or the cities own the system? Probably yes, and because they are the system.
They are the system, and maybe they should suggest companies or organizations of the like public organizations to be entrepreneurial enough and to support them in being able to, for example, run a system like Yelby. Mm. I would like to, you just talked about ecosystem and, for example, Yelby as a MaaS aggregator and mm-hmm. one of the biggest and first as far in Europe, yes. maybe even the world. Allows people to use different modes of transport based on their the use case mm. and daily situation. Did you see any kinds of change in habit, or can you maybe say something about which modes are used most based mm. on the day? Did it change anything in mobility pattern?
So Yelby was officially launched this September mm-hmm. and we entered a beta phase in June. So it has not been live for that long. And it's really hard to say what type of impact it has had based on those few months. But what we can see is that people are really changing modes quite a lot. There is a thirst for both multimodality and intermodality.
The difference would be to...
Difference would be that with intermodality, you would change between different types of transportation during the duration of a full trip.
Yes.
Whereas multimodal is just switching quite flexibly. So that's definitely something we can see. And we also recognize that the amount of early adopters, whenever we launch a new mode of mobility, is big. So what we had anticipated before was, of course, that people are keen on trying new things, but that there will be an initial barrier. Mm-hmm. But what we see when gathering all these methods under one roof is that people become more open to trying out new things. Mm-hmm. And you can take a person who has been vivid public transportation user who might not have used a lot of other different types of mobility before, suddenly being open to new types of mobility simply because it is there. Mm-hmm. You can see it. You can use it easily.
And just give it a try and see if it actually, if it helps you.
Yeah. We also see a much larger differentiation between mobility modes during rush hour. So this is sort of preempting the assumption that people tend to stick to either rail-driven mobility or road-driven cars during rush hour, but mm-hmm. this is really not the case. People, depending on the weather, of course, really try out new types of mobility then as well. However, we do see that there is a clear tendency towards first and last mile when it comes to micromobility. Those trips are shorter. Mm-hmm. They are shorter in terms of distance, they are shorter in terms of time. But equally interesting is that people are shifting towards really consuming mobility where you don't really use it only during certain hours of the day when you go to work and when you go home, but rather flexibly during the entire day.
Okay.
So you can see people really scooting from meeting to meeting.
Right.
And I think this is where we see that mobility is not this type of just service anymore. It's really something which is seen as an add-on in terms of convenience in your daily life. It's not something which is foreign or seen as I have to do this, but perhaps as something that you want to do because it makes sense for you.
And that the services help you to do that, which you probably, I don't know, I mean, you would have to talk to people and understand, would they have done this trip, this little scooting between businesses or locations during the day, maybe running some errands for half an hour because you can now.
Yes.
Because it's quick and easy to jump on a bike or on a scooter nowadays and just do what you wouldn't have done with the car because you knew you had to look for parking space or wait for the train.
And definitely, that's absolutely the case. And I believe a trend that we will see much more vividly in the future is adapting the mode of mobility towards the activity that you do. Mm-hmm. So perhaps taking a scooter to the grocery store, and when you're done and you have lots of bags, you order a shuttle service to your home.
Right.
And what I think will be interesting to see in the future is how we utilize mobility subscriptions or mobility budgets to also meet the demands of a use case which is not a single use case, but perhaps for families or dog owners or people who go to the gym a lot or whatever use case, but where you're not just, where you don't see a standard usage, mm-hmm. but something which really needs mm-hmm. a full list of mobility modes in order to just cope with your day-to-day life. Like, I would not want to have a mobility subscription only with bikes and car sharing, because I also buy groceries and after work I'm tired, I do, and then I don't want to drive a car, so I would rather be picked up, but then I have to put my stuff somewhere.
Yeah.
So I think the mobility that we see today, even if it's differentiated, this is just a starting point. We will see so many new types that we could not even imagine today. And we have to build a technology that is flexible enough to accommodate them and an infrastructure that is generous enough to make room for them.
Do you, as Strafi, experience, or did you experience in the past, or maybe it is something for the future, which we can't talk about it, but I'm thinking whether the Senate of Berlin or BVG and maybe both see in you a chance to re-engineer the idea of transportation and also all the things that you said, like, okay, now this worked fine for a while, but now can you consult, can you help us to implement all the things that you just mentioned? Is that something where you see signs, or is it something that you at least hoped to happen in the future?
I think that's the entire point also of collaborating with a fast technology company, that you get a breath of fresh air, and that you broaden your horizon. What a lot of public transit agencies are doing when collaborating with technology providers like Trafi is not only licensing tech to become more innovative and to meet demands of consumers, it's also about buying time. If you would develop this in-house, it would take years. Sometimes you have to launch something and test it and see what works, but you have to have a product.
Yeah.
And we do have a product, so we can launch immediately. I think that's one of the benefits by working with someone who is so focused and has a specific area of expertise. But coming to your question, this is something that BVG or BFG started to do even before getting in contact with Treffy. If you see the way that they are branding themselves with Es ist mir egal, weil wir dich lieben, etc., that's not the type of marketing that a traditional public transit agency is doing.
True.
So in terms of that, they have already been on that track for quite a long time. And
what a pun.
What a pun. That was intended. And
I thought it was.
It was. And it's not only about this train of innovation.
Next pun.
Thank you. You noticed.
Very good.
It's so nice.
Okay.
I'm feeling happy right now. It's not only about innovation in terms of the product, but also in terms of how you position yourself as a brand. Do you want to give the view, or do you want to perceive an image of being traditional, stuck in the tracks and not innovating? You could easily achieve that by not saying so much.
Yeah, but it's not going to change cities for the good, or giving or convincing people to get away from the private car, which is marketed big time. I mean, you know, OEMs and auto industry, they have spent billions and billions to give you the idea that this is the product that you need to fulfill all your thoughts of freedom.
That's why public transit agencies, they need to make some noise, but good noise, because at the same time as you might want to be perceived as someone who's offering a viable option, you also have to take the role of an educator in the new age of mobility. You cannot only put and present new things, you have to explain how to use them. And this is a little bit different from private providers who do not have the same public obligation because their interest is to make a profit or to prove a business model.
And they also have a more like a one-on-one touch point. If you go into a shop and buy something, be it a bicycle or a car or whatever, then you have this touch point and you can talk to people and explain why this is this or convince people into buying something. Whereas, you know, what you just said, for public transport, you don't have that. You provide a train or a bus and then like, okay, use it, go ahead.
Exactly. And with new mobility, for many people it's not self-explanatory, and the public transit agencies, if they integrate different types of mobility like we do with BVG, BFG, with Yelby, you also have the responsibility to let people know how it's supposed to be used.
Right.
And at the same time, this does not only go for the public transit agencies, but for the local governments. Like, I am not sure if people are even aware that if you're above the, I think this is for Germany as a country, but it could be only for Berlin, so I'm not completely sure, you need to double check me here. If you're above the age of 9, you are not allowed to drive a bike on the sidewalk.
Oh, that's a good question, I don't even know.
Yeah. And if you are driving a vehicle with more that could have more, I think it's more than 20 kilometers an hour, you have to wear a helmet.
Oh yeah.
So do we see people driving a kick scooter with helmets? No, very rarely. Do we see people driving their bikes on the sidewalks? All the time. This is not in accordance to the law. And
exactly,
as we get new types of mobility that will also be properly regulated, we also have to have a proper campaign or educational approach to making sure that people know what they can and cannot do.
Which is interesting that you said that, because I think the Netherlands have this focus and this mobility scenario based on bicycles, because I think they started in the 80s or somewhat 1890s. They decided to have a huge national campaign in understanding or in explaining people again and again and again why cycling is an improvement in daily life. I think they were based on fatalities, and therefore they said, okay, we need to change something. So yeah, campaigning obviously is something, and explaining and educating people is something that will help to change. Well, again, we talk about changing of habits, changing of what they do, what people do. I'm just wondering how you would do this. Is that something where you need to go back to school? Is it something where you go to the town hall and show everybody how to ride a bike or scooter properly? Like, how do you do
well,
this?
Schools is a perfect start. But another really good start is just looking at the public transit agencies and with the fantastic places for marketing that they have in place.
You mean all the billboards, all the places in the train station, like all the touch points you have daily on a daily basis?
Exactly.
Okay.
In the trains, in the buses, on the stations, Hauptbahnhof, etc. These are perfect spots where masses of people are gathered every day to introduce new types of mobility or explain how things are working. And yes, sometimes these spots are used for commercial purposes, but sometimes they are also used for advertising public transit agencies' own apps.
Yeah.
So why couldn't it be used to educate people on how they could actually, and how they should, use micromobility? It's not only for the benefit of the transport operators per se, but it's for the benefit of the people. If you don't really know what regulations you have to follow, and there's new modes of mobility popping up every day.
Interesting what you said, because, I mean, earlier you also talked about collaboration, and it brings us, I think, to the point where collaboration is something which is understood to be different in the future, not only like combining things in one application, but also to, in that case, educating people for another mode on how to... Well, yeah, how to move or to use that mode of transport. And but also, I don't know, sometimes I think it is common sense or needs to be like just using thing between your two ears and to
You mean your brain?
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. I forgot the name. to use things responsibly. But obviously it's not. So, I mean, huge part of the reason why the micromobility boom also has problems is because people are just stupid and don't behave in a very responsible way.
It's also very easy to assume what you think people know and what they don't know.
And yeah, that is, you're right. It's maybe more empathetic to go that way instead of just saying they're stupid.
But easy to forget is also that we are both in our 30s, we live in two quite big cities in Germany. We're super digitalized. We do almost everything from transactions to shopping to whatever on either our laptops or phones. There's a lot of people who fall outside that limit. And mobility can not only be developed and fostered towards people who are like us, it has to meet the demands of and the needs
of everybody. True. Which again is that's the obligation or that's the responsibility of public transport. That's the job of them to do something for everybody, which I like the idea to taking them more into account. But that would mean having more of transferring more responsibility to this operation, to this, well, agencies or the operators themselves, which I think makes sense, but maybe I'm a little bit too focused or narrow-minded for this. I find could be complicated, at least these days, if you can't really bring all the PTOs onto one table or making something which is like a mass app for the whole of Germany, at least. Yeah. So,
but we're getting there. So when
I like your positive spirit.
Yes, well, thank you. But when we were in the initial phases of conceptualizing about Yelby together with Biofaggi, we had an open call for action where we were looking for private transport providers who wanted to be integrated. And already in that meeting, we had 25 providers
that wanted to be integrated,
who said they were interested.
Okay.
This is a huge amount who opened up the doors and said, we're willing to do this together with the city.
Okay.
It's very different if you would have a private actor trying to do the same, because then you find yourself in a competitive environment.
Yes.
But the city is still a neutral player.
Yeah.
Which is why I see a huge momentum for cities to really take back the driving seat, so to speak.
The third pun, thank you.
You're welcome. And really do this now. There's this window of opportunity where people are ready. There's enough transport operators to do so. The technology is there. Cities realize that they can do this together with a partner. It's about action, like going from initial idea to actually launching. And what I strongly believe is that one cannot be afraid of launching something because it's not perfect. Because mobility will never be perfect, because it would never be finished. There will always be something new. For maybe this is a startup mentality, but you know, I also come from old institutions.
Right.
And I really believe that you have to test things out and not wait for having a perfect solution, because the solution will never be perfect.
Is that why you won the deal with BVG compared to all the other big players, Hakon, Fluidtime, you name it? How come you won?
We have a really good technology stack. We also have the possibility to build up other services like policy and analytics. Traffis, moreover, a neutral player. We're not owned by a car family or any type of OEM. So when we say that we can integrate everyone, we can, and we do.
Well, you prove.
We prove that we can do so, and we're fast. So
would you also prove?
We also prove that. I mean, we signed the contracts with BVG, I think it was in January. And in June, we had the initial testing. And in September, we officially launched. So we developed it in a couple of months. And this is, I think that's quite fast.
To understand that, did you build part of the stack before that in other cities already? Or is it actually your biggest product so far?
It's our biggest product so far. We had a similar technology in other cities, but not as advanced and not as massive as it is for Berlin. Obviously, it's a huge city with a fantastic network, and the technology needs to be so sophisticated and robust that it can handle the masses of information utilization, just the pressure on the system. So we built quite a nice solution for BVG, but it's also something that we can scale.
And what do you mean by scale?
Bring it to other cities.
And which are the other cities?
That's something I can't disclose at this very moment.
Okay, that's something to be closed at Christmas then, probably.
Closed at Christmas. But I can tell you that we are going to open up new mobility service solutions across Europe, and next year also in a few more German-speaking cities, in and outside Germany.
Interesting. Looking at the clock for once, although I would love to continue talking about these things for ages. I think we talked a lot about your vision of the future of livable cities, so I skipped that question. Maybe my last question that I keep asking is, what who would you recommend, suggest to be on the podcast? Who should I talk to in that scope? Is there somebody that comes to your mind?
Can I have more suggestions than one?
Sure, you can have as many as you want.
My first suggestion would be to talk to Caroline Yelm. She's the CMO at Voi. She's been there from the very start, and she has really taken a small Swedish band and grown it massively. I think what they are doing also in close collaboration with cities is really a good forebuild in the industry. So I would definitely recommend her. Secondly, I would speak to Valerie von der Tann, who is the GM for Berlin's ViaVan, which has the Belkönig brand together with BVG. She comes from a very interesting background at McKinsey, and she's been driving urban policy and research before. She really has good opinions on what a livable city could look like and how we could potentially get there.
Okay.
And a third one that I would be very interested to hear more from is Sigrid Nikuta.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
Maybe seeing what her actual vision for BVG is, and how you can take something which is very, very traditional and make it fit for the digital age. I would really like to hear her words on that.
Or being the CEO of Deutsche Bahn in the future. Let's see how that turns out.
Exactly.
Today.
I mean, you would have news to talk about.
Exactly. That would be news. Like, what is the news? I'm not really CEO of BVG anymore.
You would have to ask her that.
Exactly. Yeah. What are you looking forward to next year?
Me or Sigrid Nikuta?
No, you.
I am.
That's your last word.
I'm looking forward to the sun.
The sun?
The sun. I'm looking forward to the sun. No. I'm looking forward to launching in new cities. Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to connecting different types of players within our little industry together. What I'm tired of is the constant silos that we're facing. I really think that a lot of key players in mobility realize that we need to step away from competition and into collaboration.
Yeah.
And I think 2020 will be the year for that.
That is a statement. So on that bombshell, thank you so much for your time and that inspiring conversation.
Thank you, Sebastian, for having me. It was so nice.
Ein dickes Dankeschön an euch fürs Zuhören. Ich hoffe, ihr seid auf ein paar neue Gedanken gekommen. Vielleicht sind bohrende Fragen aufgetaucht oder ihr seht das Thema Mikromobilität bereits mit ein wenig anderen Augen. Auf jeden Fall freue ich mich sehr, wenn ihr meinen Podcast auf iTunes, Spotify und Co. abonniert und gerade zu Beginn fleißig weiterempfehlt. Schickt mir gerne eure Fragen, Themen und Gästewünsche per E-Mail unter hello@freifahrt-podcast.de oder in den Kommentaren bei iTunes. Dann gebe ich mir Mühe, diese in den nächsten Folgen zu berücksichtigen. In diesem Sinne, lasst die Haare wehen und gute Fahrt!